And he sat down with Emmanuel Dad.
With resources, it's a very pure and binary outcome. Normally, either a production is good enough to get to commercial viability or it isn't. That's what I really like, because it's almost like a treasure hunt in many ways.
This asset, I believe, will make up 1-2% of the GDP of the country. How do you think about that risk?
So I think that the risk of the economics being affected by royalty raises, I don't think it's going to happen. The market always struggles with valuing resource companies fairly, but then once they're de-risked, that's when you really get your big upside. You know, a good management team can't make a bad project good.
Money miners, welcome to the 16th of August, Wednesday. JD, he's gone rogue in Melbourne. We've let him out. He's like a peacock. You just got to let him fly. He's out there spreading his wings, going man solo in Melbourne, absolutely shitting bricks trying to set up cameras and audio recording equipment.
It's going rogue.
I think it's good for his professional development, don't you, Trav?
I reckon he's killing it out there. He doesn't need any of our advice on how to bloody set up equipment.
He's enjoying his Melbourne chai lattes and flash skateboards over there.
Exactly.
He's going back into hipster mode.
Yeah.
Right.
And he sat down with Emmanuel Dad.
Oh, the Datsun 180B, absolute legendary friend of the show.
Yep. Real friend,
he's a GC friend. Daddy's pretty bloody popular on the podcast today, but I'd say obviously he's gets the most benefit out of coming onto ours.
I would have thought so.
Like, no shit.
Yeah.
So any I guess preview of what they had a yarn about?
Well, I thought when we had Emmanuel on, like, the audience got a bit of a sniff of his sheer intellectual horsepower, but that was all sort of confined to the one stock, WA1, and it was, you know, that one sector, rare earths. And I think what's pretty awesome about, you know, JD going and sitting down with Emmanuel while he's in Melbourne is the fact that we get to see how Emmanuel thinks of the broader world and a lot more broader themes in this space. So I'm pretty excited to have a deep listen and go on a bit of a journey as JD unpacks his brain, mate, because I think it's a big brain.
Exactly. And the one thing that stands out to me, in addition to his intellectual capacity and fundy nous, is old Manny D is just a really nice, genuine person, absolute gentleman. So, and that goes a long way. In the industry, I think. So much kudos to him, just as a bloody good bloke. So, right, let's rip it. First up, can't forget the bloody sponsors.
No.
God, how good are partners?
Love them.
K-Drill. So pretty much the face of K-Drill, you'd say, is Rhino Sullivan. You got to meet Rhino Diggers.
I was blessed meeting Rhino.
I have talked that man up for years.
Oh, he is a legend.
Bloody legend.
I don't know how you meet all these nice people, Matty.
Did you know? I think a lot. They just gravitate towards me. Maybe I'm a nice person as well. But like, for a man that hasn't been on a drill for a while, like, you see, he's got that good frame about him. Like, solid bloke. Like, some good genetics.
Yeah.
And he's using those genetics to drive K-Drill drive the bloody drill bit into the ground to find some bloody ore for the industry.
Surface drills. But he did his time underground drilling.
Oh, he's done a bit of both.
Yeah.
He's done everything.
Yeah, but he's like K-Drill doing the surface rigs these days, mate.
Yeah. I think it's so shout out to them as a bloody great podcast partner.
Thank you, K-Drill.
And we also got our great, can't forget, Terra Capital. Pretty much anyone that comes on as a partner has to sort of pass my bromance filter, have to develop some sort of bromance, which Matty Langsford and Jeremy Bond have. Shout out to the lads.
I hope they like it.
And Dylan Kelly as well. So Terra Capital will be coming on for a show sometime again soon. So I'm keen to really dive into the TSX with them. Half their fund is in the TSX.
I'm a bit worried if that one's in person, because I'm not sure you'll be able to control yourself your side of the room.
I'll try not to kiss them on camera. Right, let's get this podcast. We have had comments on YouTube about it's too ocker and we're not good for a finance channel. But as I said on the YouTube comment, it's not tax. This is not a mandatory thing. Please go elsewhere if you don't like it. But you can stay if you want. Righto, let's rip it. JD and Emmanuel Dat from Dat Capital having a bloody good yarn. Here we go.
G'day, money miners. We've got a special guest. in store today, Emmanuel Datt from Datt Capital. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Janus. Thanks for having us.
No problem at all. Why don't we just get started by you giving a bit of an overview of yourself and then a bit about Datt Capital to start with.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been investing in resources right from the word go. I started investing myself sort of back in, it was about 2006, and I started off in resources during the good old uranium boom. And it was a really exciting time because I was sort of at the tail end of my university degree in my studies. And it's effectively the resource sector that got me hooked to investing overall. So something that we that I'm very grateful for discovering early on. And it's definitely sort of, dictated the direction of my life going forward from that stage.
Beautiful. And there's one question we need to get out of the way to start with. Mm. I saw a few years ago now, you wrote about tin. Trav would kill me if I didn't ask you, are you still a tin baron?
Yes and no. I think that, any sort of commodity tends to go through a cycle. And I think that the fundamentals are definitely improving for tin. So I am at the moment.
Beautiful. There's something I noticed on your website, a little quote I want to read out. Datt Capital is focused on generating alpha by structuring its portfolio in a unique and uncorrelated manner. Now, I want to start by digging into that unique manager, unique aspect. What do you guys do as a fund manager that is unique to compared to other fund managers?
Yeah, sure. So what we do that's unique is that we are sector agnostic. So we're not just in resources or industrials, for example. So that is something that is slightly unique, but also we invest in a concentrated manner as well. So we typically hold between 10 and 20 positions at any one stage, but also we can go across asset classes, meaning that we at this point in this in our flagship fund, which is Absolute Return Strategy, which has been running for 5 years now, we've returned 15.5% per annum net to our investors. And a lot of that, I think a lot of that performance has ultimately come from the flexibility in being able to invest in fixed income at times, and also blending that with equities, of course.
And that uncorrelated aspect lends itself to managing across asset classes and, you know, not being correlated against many different things, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, during big equity market downturns, it's always beneficial to have the downside protection of fixed interest investments. And I think that ultimately all great investors are flexible in their approach.
And how currently do you balance the fixed income versus equity balance in the portfolio?
Well, a lot of it comes down to attractive opportunities. For example, over the past 3 years, we saw interest rates go through the floor. So, of course, we weren't finding very many attractive opportunities that sort of met our hurdle rates and criteria. We've become progressively much more equity focused, and the fixed income element at this stage is quite minor and insignificant portion of portfolio. But going back to that cyclical approach, Mark, there's a time and place for any investment depending on the market cycle.
And on the fixed income aspect, has that sort of rebounded as rates have come back up, to 5%+ in the US, 4 and a bit here in Australia?
We're definitely finding more opportunities, I would say, that look to be attractive. Once you dig down, it's not always the case that they're investable. I'm definitely sort of seeing green shoots on the fixed income side.
So you guys also talk about maintaining discipline and, betting where you have the odds heavily skewed in your favour. This is something that sounds attractive and probably easier said than done. How do you maintain discipline to start with when, like you just touched on in 2021, everything's going crazy, you got rates at zero thereabouts. How do you maintain discipline through those cycles?
Sure. Well, I think a lot of it comes down to portfolio construction. You always have to be very aware of the risk, at the position level and at the portfolio level. And what I mean by that is that you need to be aware of the correlation between certain positions. that may be in the portfolio. So for example, last year we were invested in a number of coal names. And of course, these are all, you know, very heavily correlated, whereas tin and coal, probably not so much. So just being aware of you know, the correlation, but also the position sizing is something that a lot of people don't really or necessarily consider enough, I would say. You have to, it's a very fine line. You don't want to be too underweight, because ultimately you're doing the work, you want to benefit from any potential upside, but you've also got to take a very practical approach and think that, well, if a position gets cut in half tomorrow because of an externality that's unforeseen, you don't want, I mean, you can't stop the hurt, but you don't want it to hurt too much that way you can't recover.
Absolutely. And how do you go about finding those opportunities where the odds are heavily skewed?
I think that ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, you have to take a position on where you think the world will be tomorrow, ultimately. And you have to structure your portfolio in such a way that you're trying to capture what you think will happen in the future. I think that also there are very practical realities. You know, just referring back to the resources space, you know, things like the Lassonde curve, you know,
a favorite, typical sort of
market models, I would say.
Yeah.
And being familiar with these sort of models really can drive alpha ultimately, because you, if you know how the market will perceive, you know, and or you know, value an opportunity during certain points of its development life cycle, you can really generate a lot of alpha by understanding, well, you know, the valuation might tick up once they start production, for argument's sake, which is almost always the case, assuming they have no ramp up issues. So, you know, very simple, pragmatic things like that can really augment your returns over time.
Beautiful. And on idea generation as well, something I've heard you flag in the past is using social networks. Now, I assume one of them you might be touching on is Twitter there. And Twitter's one I struggle with. I find there's a lot of noise, a lot of a echo chamber type dynamic. How do you sort of separate, you know, how do you extract value from Twitter and not get, you know, drowned out with all the noise?
I think that you have to be very good at filtering information. I think that Twitter is a great equalizer because there are so many people behind anonymous profiles, for instance, that are actually very credible and well-credentialed. Ultimately, I find it a really great forum to share information and receive information as well. So, but yeah, you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, they're very good thinkers, ultimately. And even though they may not be professional investors, I think that you can amalgamate enough nuggets of information that once you aggregate it all, you know, not of course relying primarily on that, but it definitely can help inform, you know, your evaluation of a situation and ultimately a decision.
Agreed. I'd be lying if I said the guys at Money of Mine haven't picked up some ideas. There's definitely some good analysis out there. Just the separating is the key bit. On this sort of thread, from my understanding, you have six team members at DAT Capital.
I think we're at about eight now.
At about eight, okay.
Yeah.
How do you weigh getting advice from others versus getting up the the curve, so to speak, yourself on some sort of analysis, say a new commodity or something like that?
Yeah, we rely solely on internal research. And why that is because we like to really go deep into the details. We like to really understand all the drivers of any particular position without, you know, the marketing sheen, I guess, applied to it. So we want to know everything, warts and all, in a nutshell.
And how long does the process generally take for you guys to get to an investment decision?
Fairly quickly, I would say. You know, over our lifetime, as I mentioned, it's been about over 5 years since we've been operational. So we've actually got a very detailed and deep research library, I like to call it, of you know, over 1,600 odd opportunities that we've looked at over that time. So it really does speed up our our process in terms of evaluating, you know, how good a project is or how good it could be. And just being across all these details and having studied a certain sector or, you know, a deposit intensively in the past, it definitely does sort of shorten the time to evaluate.
And does that lend itself to a short-term trading dynamic, or do you prefer to stick to a buy and hold type of investment process?
We're not short-term traders by any means. We really like to identify those projects that are special. And so we really do have a quality bias. I think that it's very seductive to think that I can trade in and out of the stock in the short term, and that might generate me a bit extra, you know, a few extra bips of performance. That's not us. In a nutshell, we're after really investments that perform well and can do multiples over a multi-year time frame. That's what we're about.
And how much does instinct or intuition play into your investment process?
I think that instinct is informed by the information that you already know in many ways.
Sure.
If you gave me something fresh, like let's just say it's a resource deposit, I can probably look at the tonnage and at the grade and, you know, effectively, is that instinctive? I can instinctively look at it and say, well, that's not going to work, or maybe that's pretty good. So I think that, you know, in many ways, you know, I think instinct is different from gut, a gut feel or whatever it is. I think that typically when I look at something new, I sort of have an instinct, well, this could work, or, you know, it's not going to work at all. It's kind of a little bit binary, but it doesn't mean that we don't sort of dig deeper.
Yeah. So there's another thing that really stood out to me. I believe I read this on your website. Mm. It says that DAT doesn't engage management teams prior to making an investment. And this on the surface sounds great. Over the past few months, us at Money of Mine interviewing a bunch of people, we understand it's very hard to come to an unbiased judgment once you meet people. I think the inclination for many people is to like other people. So how do you balance, and how do you get across a management team beyond just looking at the incentive structure that the management team has in place? How do you get comfortable with them before making that investment?
I think there are a few different ways to do that. I think that, of course, you look at the incentive structure, but I think that's only a very small portion. You obviously look at their background, their skill sets, all these sort of aspects. But I think ultimately it comes down to the fact that, a good management team can't make a bad project good.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's why I say that it's probably a part of our process where you can always tell what good management teams, because the numbers will stack up, for instance, right? And ultimately, you know, it goes back to that fact that you mentioned, right, that we as individuals, we have a natural instinct to want to like the other person, right? And you tell me one CEO, or you find me one CEO that doesn't believe in their company and what they're doing.
Sure. Will you then get acquainted, whatnot, with the management once you've made an investment and become sort of closer as a manager and a company's management can be? Or will you just keep your distance?
Well, it really depends on the opportunity, I think. There have been many cases where we haven't bothered because we think, oh, well, we're across the situation. There's only so many aspects of the business and of the industry that management can control. You know, so in many cases, we haven't bothered. But I'll probably say that's not typical. You know, if we obviously want to be in a stock for a long time, over many years, in a big way, then generally we do like to engage with management teams after, you know, sort of the investment decision.
Yeah, it is actually an aspect where I think that does differ somewhat. There's many other managers that we speak with that are quite dependent, for want of a better word, in following highly regarded management teams. You know, the likes of Mark Clark at Capricorn sticks out, and the backers will follow them stock to stock. How does, why rather did you guys start the firm as an absolute return firm rather than, say, relative return?
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess it all stems back to the fact that I was managing my family's capital sort of prior to setting up the fund itself. And so I did very well. And it was really, the Absolute Return Fund was really an extension of what we were already doing and that we're very comfortable with. Ultimately, I'm very focused and conscious of having downside protection whilst not capping my upside.
But you also don't utilize short selling in your in your sort of framework. Why is that? What are the sort of pitfalls of short selling in your opinion?
I think short selling is overrated. I think that there've been many academic studies to sort of demonstrate that, well, in many cases, short selling doesn't add value, you know, because you have many different risks. You have counterparty risk, for example. Cost risk because, you know, the cost of short selling changes day on day. And ultimately it wasn't aligned with my personality. I'm generally an optimistic person. I like to think the best, you know, of the opportunities at hand. And but ultimately, right, all I need to do is make sure I'm not investing in bad opportunities, and I'm going to make money either way. And also short selling is labor intensive as well.
Yeah, and the capital upside, obviously. Yeah. There was one thing that stood out. I think I heard you say on a recent podcast that you currently are admiring a few managers out there, one of them being Carl Icahn, a favorite of mine as well. Does this sort of indicate that you guys would get active like Carl has famously done throughout his career?
I think in limited situations, yes. I think that activism does have a role. And I guess in Australian markets, we really haven't seen it being done well or in the right sort of manner, which I think it should be done. I think it's a really interesting space. And I think, you know, over the years ahead, it's quite possible we might get involved in certain situations.
Mm. It's interesting there on the flip side as well, you have seen big managers from the US retreat from being quite active. Bill Ackman, Dan Loeb sort of come to mind. They've sort of tried their hand at it and for whatever reason decided to take a step back. Emmanuel, I'm keen to move on to macro now. You have spoken about inflation in the past. On interest rates to start with, are you in the sort of higher for longer camp, or do you think the RBA and the Fed are going to, you know, retract relatively soonly?
Yeah, well, look, I look at real interest rates for starters. So for those that know, that's basically the cash rate minus the rate of inflation. So I think that ultimately, you know, real interest rates have been negative for some years now. Do I think this will persist? I would probably say yes. I think that, you know, it's really important to observe what the changes and dynamics of society, you know, what's going to happen in the future. You see certain initiatives like the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, which is really pushing their society towards electrification. I think that then, you know, on the other hand, you have, you're going to have a period, at the moment is, you know, solar, for example, electric vehicles, are they really sustainable without subsidies? I would probably argue no at this stage.
Is the Inflation Reduction Act anything but inflationary?
I don't disagree with you there. And that's kind of the point I'm getting to, you know, that for initiatives like the Inflation Reduction Act to be successful, I'll probably say that real interest rates have to be, you know, very low.
And does that sort of, picking up on that thread, do you think inflation sort of takes longer than some may anticipate to wind back to that targeted band that central banks have, or do you see it hovering around where it is?
Yeah, I think that inflation will remain elevated. For instance, the RBA inflation target is between 2% and 3%, but I think the latest rolling 12-month figure was 6%. So we're sitting at double. the you know, target rate at the upper end.
We have for quite some time.
And we have for quite some time. So I think it will remain elevated. And of course, one reason for that is, you know, we're still at, I think the latest unemployment figure was 3.5%. Back in uni, I was always taught that full employment is 4%. Or regarded as 4%. So it's been over full inflation for, you know, a couple of years now, I'd say. And it doesn't look like it's easing, you know, enough, I would say.
So these interest rates, they've played into another dynamic that you've touched on in the past. And that's the divergence in valuations between the big cap and the small cap stocks on the ASX. And the interest rates sort of flow in by having a higher cost of capital, which is... you know, affected some companies more than others. And this has led to DAT starting a small cap fund in the near term, I believe.
Yes.
What is the catalyst for the mean reversion here? Is it just interest rates coming down? That is the catalyst, or is there something else that leads to the sort of mean reversion, as you say?
Well, I think that ultimately, as you mentioned, I think this divergence between the small cap indexes and, you know, the larger cap indexes, this has only occurred a few instances in the last 30 years. And when this divergence has occurred, typically over the next 3 to 5 year period, we've seen very strong returns from the small cap space as these indexes converge again. Small caps typically trade at higher valuations during periods of stability. Right now, recently we've gone through, I guess the best way to describe it is there's been more uncertainty and fear, which lends itself to, you know, investors trying to get into big caps because they're obviously more liquid and lower risk, of course. But yeah, you know, I think that small caps will once again have their day in the sunshine, but we're ultimately looking to find the best exposures in the space itself. So to answer your question, I think that investor confidence building investor confidence over time ultimately leads to the, you know, re-rate of these small cap opportunities. And of course, we've seen plenty of corporate M&A action from private equity, from, you know, very clever investors ultimately on public markets. And that really does tell you something, that there's some value to be found.
Sure. So there's something you touched on there, which I want to dive into deeper. It's the liquidity or illiquidity in the small cap space. How do you manage that illiquidity and also make sure you get compensated for that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, as you know, allude to, illiquidity should be, you know, there should be always an illiquidity premium, they call it in finance parlance, as you're probably aware. I guess in the past, during markets where there's a lot of confidence, it basically is non-existent. Right now, I think that the illiquidity premium is accentuated, you know, over and above what it should be. And I think that it's very difficult to quantify it to ascribe a certain percentage or anything like that. I think that it's very much determined by asset quality, as it should be, because ultimately asset quality is something that you're investing in for the medium term, and that gets you out of the liquidity constraints, you know. And I think that's why, you know, we're so focused on, investing in quality assets for the medium to long term.
We've also seen plenty of managers leave the space as well, right, over the past decade or so, which just compounds the impact and I guess something that you'd want to pick up on as an advantage going into the small cap arena.
Oh, absolutely. And, I know that there are a lot of small cap passive vehicles like small cap ETFs that attempt to replicate, you know, small cap returns across just a broad index, which I think is a totally wrong way to do things, by the way. But these sort of vehicles are starting to lose money and having to sell down indiscriminately.
You're saying it's the wrong way of doing it. Is that because they just can't buy in at reasonable prices because some of these things trade 10,000 shares a day or something more than that?
Yeah, well, basically with ETFs, they're generally market capitalization weighted, and they obviously consider liquidity amongst other factors. But it doesn't mean that every highly valued stock is a good investment opportunity over the medium to long term. We've seen
even more so in the short term, in the small cap space, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You've seen like lots of stuff like GameStop and AMC. You've seen just some crazy movement because people realize that in a stock with limited liquidity, if you've got enough money behind you, you can really push valuations up to somewhat incredible values.
Sure.
In some instances.
And another reason for not wanting to be a short seller, right?
Oh, no.
there's another dynamic, and I think you're a great person to speak to about this because you're not entirely resource focused. You go across sectors. So there's a dynamic we see when you say you value a resource business, mm-hmm. and you do the standard way, it'd be create a DCF, and you don't have a terminal value because mm-hmm. the mine life is the mine life, and that's when the asset is done.
Yeah.
Comparing that to say a tech or industrial business, mm-hmm. let's go tech. You use a terminal value for the theoretical value that the business will earn mm-hmm. beyond whatever the amount of years you sort of forecast. But when you actually look at the tech space, there's many companies that don't last more than one, tech advancement or cycle. Mm-hmm. They're not there, 15 or 20 years later, unless they're one of the behemoths like Apple, Microsoft has shown. Do you think this is a sort of shortfall in how investors value these businesses, or do you think it's warranted?
I think it's very short-sighted, and I think that good operators or good, people with a long-term view can really take advantage of these valuation mismatches, right? As you allude to, I think that technology companies, I think in many instances, are overvalued. I think that, sure, you have great franchises, the Googles and the Microsofts, sure, I get that they are valued for the reasons, because they've obviously got great franchise and longevity in their business models and sustainability, most importantly. But you see a lot of small cap tech companies that, you just deep into the numbers and the business models, and it's like, why are these valued so high? Yeah. These will never be sustainable, etc. Whereas it's not necessarily the case in resources. I think that with resources, it's a very pure and binary outcome. Normally, either a production is good enough to get to commercial viability, or it isn't. And that's what I really like, because it's almost like a treasure hunt in many ways. And I think that the market is always struggles with valuing resource companies fairly. But then once they're de-risked, that's when you really get your big upside.
And that's the opportunity, I guess, you're speaking to, getting in there before you have the re-rate, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that we've definitely sort of proven the ability to recognize what good quality opportunities are at a very early stage. And it's so stimulating to be able to look at smaller companies and that are trying to do bigger things ultimately, and being able to really look at things with a hard commercial lens is what's needed. And you can find some really great gems out there, I think.
Agreed. So I think we should get into some more commodities before we get into some stocks. You mentioned prior that you'd invested in the energy complex, specifically in coal before, and I'm not sure if you're still in the space, but what I want to specifically ask you about is the risk and how you hedge it as it relates to royalties or super taxes or, those similar sort of things. As we've seen it more and more. We saw it in New South Wales, in Queensland last year.
Yeah.
How do you think about that?
Well, I think the beauty is, because these are obviously larger cap names that we invest in the coal space in particular, the great thing is that you don't need to hold that exposure throughout periods of uncertainty. The great thing about that is that you're able to, de-risk your portfolio as much as you like, because there's no real liquidity constraints with the larger ASX call positions, which are the best ones, to be honest. I think that it's all about weighting your market exposure. The New South Wales budget will be coming out in September. So that is obviously something that I think will be quite critical to see, you know, what the prospective returns are. I think the last thing anyone wants to see is a Queensland situation, which I felt was really onerous, you know, and it's really set the state back a lot, I would say, in terms of investor perception.
I think BHP would take your point of view as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, ultimately, it's something that I have definitely observed. You know, the governments globally are becoming a lot more proactive about trying to capture returns from these sort of assets. Look at what's going on in Africa, for instance.
Yeah, the resource nationalism rise isn't abiding anytime soon, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's not only restricted to jurisdictions like Africa now, right? If a state like Queensland can enforce such punitive actions against the resource industry, it really does lift the perception of sovereign risk overall. Sure, there'll obviously be states that don't do that. Hopefully WA doesn't do that anytime.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, but it really does make investing in Western Australian assets a lot more attractive relatively than Queensland or New South Wales, presumably, if they lift the royalty rates on coal going forward.
So I want to touch on rare earths, which is a sector I know you're somewhat close to. Mm-hmm. And this really ties in with the resource globalization as well, given the China dominance in this sector. So we recently saw Peak Rare Earths move away from their sort of stance of being non-China aligned. They were going to go downstream in England. And they've done a bit of a U-turn on that. They now have a major Chinese shareholder and they've signed an offtake with that same party.
Yeah.
Is there any other way you see? Obviously, we've got Eniaba and other things in the works and MP Materials in the US, but is there any other way for juniors in the rare earth space to, you know, take advantage without being partnered with a Chinese player?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that in Africa, Chinese influence is extremely strong, you know, far more than any other Western nation, in my opinion. So I think that if you have a resource or holding a resource in Africa, I think Chinese, participation in the project at some level is inevitable, ultimately. However, if you're holding a rare earth deposit in Western Australia, it's a very different proposition. We have Lynas re-onshoring, a good portion of their processing to Western Australia, but you've also got Iluka that's been government funded, for a rare earth refinery in WA as well. So I think that ultimately lowers the bar for upstream rare earth deposits in Western Australia, because you can just be trucked to Lynas or Iluka, presumably. Yeah. And I'm not sure if Hastings are still undergoing their own processing operation.
We'll have to see about that one.
Yeah, but it doesn't look too promising at this stage.
Yeah.
I think that ultimately it's a good thing, to have multiple avenues of commercialization.
Beautiful. We'll get onto the stock-specific section. There's a couple of names I know you've spoken about that we'll get into. So you recently played a hypothetical game with Livewire where you had $10,000 to hypothetically invest across three names and you could keep a portion in cash.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about two of them, given two were resource companies. Yeah. So first up, WA1. And I know you've spoken with Trav and Maddie in the past about this one. Some things have changed since then, but things are still going full steam ahead at WA1. And I do need to declare that I'm a shareholder as well. I like the story. But I want to speak to you firstly about MET. That's the big concern with me. And I want to know how you get comfortable with the MET. I know they've done some preliminary analysis, but how do you get comfortable given it's just such a big risk for a stock like this?
I think the really great thing about WA1 is just the sheer grade of the deposit. I think that, in terms of our own calculations, we expect the deposit to be, you know, over 2% in terms of any sort of resource estimate that they put out. So even if you're recovering, if you're able to recover only 50% of that, that's still higher grade than any other deposit aside from Araxa at the moment. So I think that makes it still incredibly robust, I would say, even assuming very poor recoveries.
Sure. And then on the outcomes from what they produce there, are you more excited or more focused on the potential alloy aspect or the potential battery alignment or just both?
I would say both. I think that, of course, as a base case, you would assume ferroniobium would be, which is obviously used in the steel industry. Considering it's 90% of niobium consumption, that's what you have to really focus on ultimately at the start of the project. Of course, the niobium battery technology is still in the process of being commercially validated. So that's almost like a moonshot opportunity that may or may not happen. So I think that, you've got to be really focused on what the near-term drivers are in terms of the product production rather than investing in fairy tales or maybes.
And on the market downstream, how do you sort of view this? I think the numbers were 120,000 tons was the total consumption last year of niobium. Are you sort of the belief that it's a market that can grow and increase supply will bring about increased demand? Or do you just think that they have a higher grade product and they can force their way into whatever the market is? How do you think about that?
I think it works both ways. I think that they could, given Araxa produces, I think, about 85% of global production, you've got 15% to attack immediately because ultimately, I think at this point, I think it's quite clear that this is the world's second best deposit out there after, Araxa, which produces 85%. So in that aspect, I think that, assuming... of course, there are many boxes to be ticked off until production. But I really do think the diversity of supply angle is going to be important as well. And ultimately, it's driven by very real factors and practicalities, ultimately. In construction, weight equals cost. And if there's the opportunity to reduce that weight at a very low cost, per ton, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't BlueScope start incorporating niobium in steel produced locally, for instance, right?
Absolutely.
With their clear advantages.
So the second stock you mentioned there was Global Lithium. And to be completely honest, on their scoping study that came out in February of this year, I wasn't convinced by some of the assumptions that they'd used. I think there was a lofty lithium forecast price and a few other bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. What makes you think this company is undervalued or perhaps that the market isn't quite seeing as you see it?
Well, I think this resource has a lot of strategic value. And why I say that is we've seen takeovers of essential metals, for instance, or attempted takeovers. Essential metals, I think their deposit is only about 12 million tons at a fairly low grade.
Yeah, I think
it's quite similar to GL1.
Yeah, similar grade, yeah.
Yeah. So I think the fact that you had IGO and you had Mineral Resources, two of the biggest lithium participants in Australia buying for, what looks to be a fairly modest sized resource, really does tell you something. I think GL1 really do have good potential exploration upside as well. In addition to what we think, we think they're undervalued just based on their current resource of, I think it's about 55 million tons at the moment. I think that also, the scoping study would probably encapsulate capital expenditure that may not be required if it's bolted onto someone like Mineral Resources operations, which is quite close by.
So I think Maddie's punt was that, given developers now taken out Essential and they have the tie-in with MinRes, Yeah. MinRes also has, I think, a 10% stake in
GL1.
Yeah.
And
he thinks Develop and MinRes sooner or later will bandy together.
Yeah.
That's his long shot prediction of how that all marries up. But there are merits to it given the synergies that could be experienced between Mount Marion, you know, Essentials, Pioneer Dome, in the area, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that ultimately in resources, they don't need Develop in this case, because why would you want to share, you know, your economics ultimately?
Absolutely.
And so that's just what I think will happen. And, you know, ultimately there's been just a huge push towards, you know, midstream and downstream players, even, you know, the actual manufacturers are getting into upstream supply. And you have to ask your question, why would Ford be, you know, funding Liontown, for instance, if they weren't, you know, confident that supply would be available at some future date? And it's very rare, you know, ultimately, when you think about it, you know, logically.
Yeah, the push downstream has been pretty enormous.
Mm.
There's another stock I want to talk about, Dreadnought. Mm-hmm. I've also heard you touch on this one in the past. So they've got a resource coming out relatively soon. And I mean, they've also had a share price that's come off 50-odd percent over the past year or year to date.
Yeah.
What do you weight to the share price coming off, the reasoning behind that, and how much sort of stock do you put in this upcoming resource?
Yeah, I think that it's a good one. I think that Dreadnought, I think that they are obviously still at the process of discovering what exactly they have on their ground. I think they have certainly been hamstrung by sort of delayed assays and all that sort of thing. But, you know, they've just got a great, package of ground, and they've had, you know, I think their resource itself, it's a really good, a resource that they've put out, given that I think the discovery was made only about a year ago or so. And yeah, I think that, you know, it's still an evolving story, of course. And I think it's of significant strategic value, ultimately.
The last stock I want to talk about is Adriatic. And this is another one that we on the show have spoken about quite fondly. We've interviewed Paul Cronin and Matt Hines. And we quite like it, but they came out with this capital raise last week that kind of ticked me off. They're 3 or so months from production. And I know they did make it explicitly clear that the money was for exploration, and they're not trading at all-time lows or anything like that, so it wasn't the most dilutionary of raises.
Yeah.
So to start with, what did you make of the capital raise?
I was I guess a little surprised as well, to be honest, but however I thought through things, and I guess it's really a question, when do you delay, like how long, like, of course, they're coming into production towards the end of this year, and presumably we'll have, you know, cash flows coming in from December, January, let's say, assuming, nothing, everything's on critical path.
Yep.
So this raise, I believe, was done to sort of progress exploration. And I can understand that rationale. You know, they've had a lot of success extending the existing deposit, and you know, I think the latest mine life is about 20 years, I'd say, going off the latest MRE. With these sort of companies, you know, when they're when you're financing a project into production, typically you're somewhat constrained in what you can spend your cash by the project financier on. So, you know, a project financier doesn't want them going out and pouring money into exploration holes, just in case, you know, the project's delayed, and then, you know, that kicks the risk profile out. So I believe the raise was informed on that basis, you know. So, but what the raise does, it really gives them the capacity to go out and continue drilling aggressively and adding value through the drill bit, ultimately, and kicking that LOM or extending that LOM, which I think will be a big value uplift.
I'm still suspicious, but time will sort of tell how that plays out. And I'm hopeful, because the guys have impressed me in the past. How do you think of the re-rate there as they move from developer to a producing? What sort of, you know, numbers would you anticipate that the company would be valued on in future?
Yeah, I think it'll be significant. I guess it all really depends on, so given it's a polymetallic deposit, and I think they're selling about three separate products in terms of concentrates out of that project, I think a lot will ultimately come down to what sort of payability they can prove to the market, presuming that it's in line with their study parameters. I'll probably say that there's still significant upside in this name.
And the last bit I wanted to touch on Adriatic is something that's sort of been front and center very recently. So when you look at various resource stocks out there, you often think some things look a bit too good to be true, and it's often with good reason, especially in riskier jurisdictions. So for me, Leo Lithium comes to mind, and the cash flows that they were imminently printing from their DSO operations in Mali looked too good to be true, and the stock did re-rate quite well, and now they're in trading halt, and they have been so for a month or so. How do you think about Adriatic in this context? They've got a 10% corporate tax rate in Bosnia, which historically has a mining jurisdiction been strong, but not in recent times. And this asset, I believe, will make up 1% to 2% of the GDP of the country. How do you think about that risk?
Yeah, it's a bit of a long string to draw, I guess, between comparing Mali to Bosnia. I guess Bosnia is part of Europe ultimately, and it's Adriatic itself is being financed by the European Bank for Redevelopment and Reconstruction, I think it's called. So very credible institution over there. So I think that the risk of the economics being affected by royalty raises, I don't think it's going to happen, given the lack of mining, current mining, I should say, in Bosnia. It is a risk, though.
My only pushback would be Jadar, I think that's how you pronounce it, the Rio Tinto asset.
Yes.
Obviously not in Bosnia, it's in Serbia, nearby.
Yeah.
But that's the only one that sort of comes to mind.
Yeah. Well, I think that was more of a permitting issue rather than royalty related. And, I think that Jadar does get built in time, ultimately. But, I think that it's very, very difficult to compare Adriatic's deposit in any way, shape or form to any other, jurisdiction and project. It's something that's very unique and very high quality, ultimately.
And how would you go about selling down a stake in that? Do you sort of see once they've had a re-rate and you think they're fully valued, or is this, do you think I don't want to hold it through a cycle? How do you kind of think about letting go of the shares once you've, made a decent return on your investment?
Well, when I start getting pitched for stock, that's when I know I've got to hold on a bit longer. I've been pitched for plenty of times.
Okay, I can tell you that.
In all seriousness, I think that you really have to see what, or how much weight you want to carry as a proportion of the portfolio. And I think that there comes a point in time when generally a position grows too big, given the nature of the company or where the company is positioned in its development life cycle. And when you start to feel uncomfortable about, it's a potential downside, right? Everything in life and everything in the markets has risk. When you become unusually focused or thinking a lot about that, positional risk, I think that's definitely the time when you've got to cut down.
Great. Love it, Emmanuel. I want to finish on a underrated versus overrated section. This is a little dynamic that the money miners have liked. So I'm just going to spit out stock names, commodities, various things, and one word answers: underrated, overrated.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's start. Vulcan Energy Resources.
Overrated.
Midstream production of lithium in Australia, e.g. what Pilbara Minerals are aiming to do.
I would probably say overrated.
Centaurus Metals, who have the Jaguar nickel deposit in Brazil.
Overrated.
Being based in Perth to invest in resources, overrated or underrated?
Underrated.
Inflation, higher for longer.
Underrated.
Sayona Lithium.
Overrated.
Metals Acquisition Corp, the SPAC that's going to list sooner or later here in Australia.
I'm neutral because I don't know too much about it.
Safe. Piedmont Lithium.
Overrated, I'd say.
Gaining Alpha from FinTwit.
Underrated.
Metals X.
Underrated.
And lastly, Downstream Battery Production in Australia.
Overrated.
Beautiful. Thanks a lot for your time, Emmanuel. I'm sure the money miners will really love it, and I've learned plenty. So cheers.
Thanks, Janice.
Well, it appears JD finally got all the cameras and audio working by himself. Congrats, JD.
He had a ripping conversation, JD.
What a legend.
That was awesome.
What a legend. And Manny D, what a great bloke. Absolute gentleman. And as you said, hyper bloody intelligent. And it's just a constant tone of knowledge coming out of his mouth, Manny D.
Yeah, the more he talks and the less we do.
The more he talks, the more stupid I feel. Yeah. So. Right, thanks again to all the podcast partners, the Money of Mine partners. Buddy, oh God, I nearly got to have them written up in front of me. We're getting that many. Top Drill, K-Drill, JP Search, Anytime Exploration and Terra Capital. We appreciate all your support for Money of Mine. It is keeping the lights on.
Thank you very much, partners. And hoodaroo.
Hoodaroo.
The information contained in this episode of Money of Mine is of general nature only and does not take into account the objectives, financial situation or needs of any particular person. Before making any investment decision, you should consult with your financial advisor and consider how appropriate the advice is to your objectives, financial situation and needs.